In this eighth episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I sit down with Bob Mallard to discuss his work promoting native fish in the Northeast with the Native Fish Coalition. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Bob Mallard. Bob has fly fished for 40 years. He is a former fly shop owner and a registered Maine fishing guide. Bob is also a blogger, writer, author, fly designer, and native fish advocate. He is the publisher, Northeast regional editor, and a regular contributor to Fly Fish America magazine, a columnist with Southern Trout Online magazine, and a staff fly designer at Catch Fly Fishing. His writing, photographs, and flies have been featured at the local, regional, and national level in several magazines and books. Bob himself has written two books, 50 Best Places Fly Fishing in the Northeast, and 25 Best Towns Fly Fishing for Trout, and has contributed to several others. Bob is currently working on books about Maine and brook trout. When not fishing or writing about fishing, Bob is a founding member and a national vice chair of the Native Fish Coalition. Welcome to the podcast, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Bob, it sounds like you really love fishing. Did you ever have a regular day job, or did you just jump right into guiding and running fly shops?
I spent 20 years in high tech, software and business consulting, marketing, etc. I checked out at the peak of my earnings in my early 40s. Decided to do something else. I like to say I spent 20 years doing work I didn't like, in places I didn't want to be, around people I couldn't relate to. So it was a kind of a natural progression. But I have fished for my whole life.
You've fished your whole life, and you've obviously good enough to contribute to a bunch of magazines and books and guide people. When did the writing part of it come in?
When I first checked out of high tech and opened a fly shop, because of, you know, I opened in Maine. Maine is a rural state, and we don't have a lot of celebrity up here. We did at one point, but so things are kind of quiet, and I just kind of found my way into local writing. Most of it was fishing. A little bit of it was fishing commerce, and I started in some of the local hook and bullets and letters to the editor. The local newspapers always want to know, you know, the new guy in town and what you're doing. And that morphed in a column, a gear column with one of the local hook and bullets. And the next thing was I was approached by Fly Fish America to write some pieces about Maine. And next thing I know, I was kind of freelancing around. And then I got approached to write a couple of chapters for Wendy and Terry Gunn's Tailwater book, and that led to me doing my Northeast book. And then I went at them myself, proposed this Towns book I did, and meanwhile, my role at Flatfish America increased to regional editor and eventually publisher, and I got picked up as the lone Yankee in a Southern publication, kind of a gear column that has bounced around a bit. It looks like I'm going to start a fiberglass fly rod column. That's how it all started. And of course, you know, I did some sidebars in other people's articles, chapters in other people's books. And it's a small little community, relatively. And once you're in, you know, you get people who tap into you, and off you go, working harder than anyone else for less money.
I'm sure your love of fishing as well as your writing has taken you all over, and you've had a lot of time to fish a whole bunch of different waters throughout the U.S. Nobody or nothing is perfect, but of all the places you've fished, which of these comes the closest?
From a pure fishing standpoint, you can't beat Montana. They've done a remarkable job of promoting fishing as a, you know, an industry in and of itself, and recreational fishing. They're blessed with cold water, rich water, and smart management. But with that said, over the years, I evolved from being just into fishing, and bigger is better, and didn't really care about species or origin or necessarily whether they were stocked or wild. And so I've changed a lot And my current thing is I've kind of gone back to the beginning, and I'm really become a native fish guy. And Montana's not the best native fish state. If you're talking Rocky Mountains, Wyoming's got more cutthroat than Montana. And Maine has more brook trout than anyone else. And so that's kind of where I'm at now. I'm doing a lot of small stream fishing. This is after 20 years rowing a drift boat, or 25, and having fished pretty much, I won't say every, but I made one hell of a dent in the nation's finest trout water, and fished in easily a couple dozen states and hundreds of waters. Now I'm really spending my time other than, close to home, which is a non-native brown trout fishery. But when I'm on the move, I tend to be focused on native fish, rare fish. And that's what drove me from a fishing-centric writing to somewhat of a fish-centric writing. It's also what's behind my advocacy. For a long time, I advocated better fishing, better fisheries management, better fishing economy. Somewhere along the way, everything changed, and I realized that fish was more important than, or were more important than fishing, and pretty much dropped my fishing advocacy. While I still do some fishing writing, my advocacy is solely directed toward wild native fish.
Like I said, you fish a lot of different waters and probably seen some pretty pristine conditions, but you've probably also seen quite a few degraded systems. From your travels, what is the largest issue or problem that you've observed?
I mean, again, I'd separate fishing from fish. From a fishing standpoint, and probably the trout angler most guilty, is we've become horribly reliant on, accepting of, stocking non-native species. I would say no sportsman in America has become more accepting of husbandry and, artificial waters, artificial hybrids, stocking non-natives. So that has degraded a lot. While the bighorn's a wonderful fishery, it's a horribly degraded ecosystem as a result of damming a desert river and creating a 50-degree tailwater where you once had a warm, muddy river that was home to some pretty cool fish, although not necessarily game fish. So the whole reliance on husbandry, it's not a good thing. When a trophy comes off the back of a truck, and whether it was dumped in yesterday or months ago, when that is satisfactory, I think we've lost a lot. One of my kicks lately is the average state fish and game department has something on their website that says, see where we stocked yesterday. And to think that, and I was guilty as charged, that is this where it's all heading? Is it this immediate gratification? Is it that we're just going to follow trucks around and pull farm-raised fish out of the water? I hope not. But as far as, outside of that manufactured world, on our wild native waters, the biggest issue we have is non-native fish. Habitat's the hot button today, but I would argue that while it's the biggest problem in some places, it's not the biggest problem everywhere. In fact, Maine is losing wild native salmonid waters to non-native fish at a significantly higher clip than we're losing them to habitat. The big 10,000-pound gorilla is certainly climate changes. As I said before we went on, it was 81 degrees in central Maine today. That's crazy. I went down the river to check the temps and see if the fall hatches had started, and it was 62 degrees. That water should be 52. I just came back from a river up a couple hours north of me that gets a fall brook trout spawning run. Used to go in September 1st and fish would be there. We were there the last weekend of the season, end of September, and these fish were there, but not in the numbers they should have been. In fact, nowhere near the numbers they should have been. That's a huge looming threat, but hopefully we'll smarten up and do something to turn that. But my area is probably at much higher risk than the Rocky Mountains due to low elevation, warm water. We have a long summer, a long hot summer. And, whether fish, trout are living in everything from sea level to 1,000 feet above sea level is considered, high elevation for trout. And elevation covers many sins. That's what keeps a lot of these waters cold. So there's a whole bunch of things going on wrong at once. We've got stocking, we've got non-native fish proliferation, we have changing climate. In addition to what we're seeing with warming the water temps, we're also seeing some flooding that is not normal. The bighorn has been, 2 years, she's been blown up pretty hard, and New Hampshire took a hit late October last year that did the most damage to some of the rivers I fish that I've ever seen. These extreme weather events, not only do they damage, but of course, municipalities come in afterwards and try to mitigate flooding by bulldozing streams. And there's a lot going wrong at once right now.
The one you mentioned first when you first started, and then when you did your little recap, was non-native fish. And this must be something you were passionate about, because as I mentioned, you were a co-founder and you're the national vice chair of the Native Fish Coalition. And this is a nonpartisan grassroots nonprofit organization dedicated to the conservation, preservation, and restoration of wild native fish. When did this organization form, and what events kind of led up to that formation?
We're about a year old. Myself, conservation icon Ted Williams, a young woman named Emily Bastian, who's worked for Fish and Game, and she's worked for Audubon, AMC, Park Service, etc. She's a degree biologist, and a couple others. We just felt that we were taking our eye off the prize. Some of the bigger corporate conservation groups, they're either not in the fish game at all, or those that are drifting dangerously toward fishing. They're wild trout, not native trout. We've got a lot of clean water nonprofits out there that feel the job is done when your kids can swim. And to walk away because the water is clean, you might be able to drink it, your children can swim in it, and say all is well, that's short-sighted when it's full of invasive fish and stockfish and et cetera. So that's what kind of led to the formation of the group, was we felt there's somebody needs to step into that void and kind of refamiliarize people with what is and isn't native, or why does it matter, what's wrong with non-native fish. And most of that's coming out of small groups right now. Sea Run Brook Trout Coalition, you spoke with Jeff Day recently, Downey Salmon Federation, Native Fish Society, Protect Rhode Island Brook Trout. So it's interesting, there's this little kind of micro movement right now within the conservation community that's this ecological enlightenment that folks need to start looking at, native fish again. I don't believe we'd be accepting of ostriches and, as a walking around our woods. I don't believe that we would be happy with, in some cases, there's some non-native pheasant stuff, but in general, does Maine want to replace native grouse with pheasants? Do we want farm-raised deer? So that's really what's driving not only us, but all these small groups that are, call them what you want, they're splinter groups. If the big guys were doing everything that needed to be done, these small groups wouldn't need to be, they wouldn't be forming, because it's not easy. Today's world, it's a tough nut to crack to create a non-prof and try to live off the scraps of the big guys, and there's no money for staffing, and you've got to earn your way into grants and stuff. So, these guys are, most of them are working for nothing or peanuts. We don't have any paid staff. And meanwhile, some of these larger non-profs, conservation non-profs, the folks are, the executive director makes hundreds of thousands. So, that's the big challenge. But part of the whole thing is to just kind of step back in and maybe backwards and I get to a point where I'm talking to people who are relatively educated and read, and yet they're referring to, brown trout as a native brown trout. And what they really mean is they're wild brown trout or native rainbows. Again, they're wild rainbows. And without getting too deep into it, the impact, swapping brook trout for brown trout isn't simply bumping out brook trout. It's a highly piscivorous fish that's preying on other native minnows and some of the worst non-native problems we have. We've got in Maine, we've got muskies running the St. John River. They've basically wiped out 50 miles of wilderness native brook trout water. They're nipping at the Allegash Falls, putting the fabled Allegash Wilderness waterway at risk. We've got, you know, bass in the Rapid River right now. It's the premier wild native brook trout river in the country, and it's full of bass now. We've lost 3 out of 11 Arctic char waters in under a decade to invasive smelts. And, you know, when you lose 3 out of 11 populations remaining in the contiguous United States, that should be a wake-up call. You know, I just lost my favorite remote brook trout pond to invasive golden shiners. So clearly, you know, we've kind of lost our way on this one. And in many cases, people truly don't know. It just seemed like, other than these small groups that are scattered, that are geographically focused, it just wasn't getting done. And, you know, being in Maine, we have a lot to save. We have 90% of the pond-dwelling brook trout left in the country, native pond-dwelling brook trout left in the country, 90% of the sea-run brook trout left in the country. We have most of the large river brook trout, and we have all of the Arctic char. We have the last of the Atlantic salmon, and yet we didn't have a focused native trout group. So that's where we started in Maine, and we branched off in New Hampshire and Vermont, who have their own problems. So that's, you know, the kind of stuff we're addressing. A lot of it's just education, information and education. Try to reel in, excuse the pun, but, you know, reel in the angling community. I mean, it all starts there. You know, we were the ones who saved native fish from the brink, and we probably need to do that once again.
You brought up an interesting point at the beginning of your answer there, that it's often difficult to try to illustrate some of these problems to people that aren't out there experiencing them. And you mentioned that you won't replace your native grouse with ring-necked pheasant, like you wouldn't replace your native brook trout with brown trout. How would you try to illustrate that point to some of the people that don't see these problems?
Fish present a bigger challenge than almost anything because they're not seen. If you're not an angler, you don't see them. It's not like eagles soaring over and whales breaching and, you know, moose sticking their head out of the bushes. So you're in trouble with fish right out of the gate because the only obvious ally are anglers. And in many cases, anglers have become part of the problem. So you're trying to get people first to understand what's there and how beautiful they are and how important they are, and try to convince them that this isn't just about fish. It's not just about fishing. This isn't, reclamations are not being done, hopefully, to create, you know, fisheries for anglers. They should be being done to restore native populations and address, you know, these seriously compromised ecosystems. When you talk to somebody about invasive shiners that are impacting insect life, that is, you know, taking food out of the mouths of bats, etc., that's how you find your way in with the non-fish conservation people. The kind of case study, it's the lake trout, invasive lake trout in Yellowstone Lake. That is horrific as it is. It's you know, it is the worst fisheries-related catastrophe we've suffered. But it's making people understand. Pelicans can't eat. Ospreys can't eat. Grizzlies have lost a critical food source. Otters, you know, can't chase lake trout. So that's done a lot to educate, you know, the public in the most visible, you know, wildlife management area in the country. You know, so that's, you know, the real challenge to the non-fish conservation world is to link some of what we're suffering to some of what they're suffering. Most of these people understand things like trophic cascades and food webs, so they just need to understand where fish play and why they're important, because it has to go the fish, so goes everything that relies on them.
On your website, states that you are primarily, but not exclusively, focused on salmonids. Why that focus, and why not just native species in general? Is it just that most of your native fish up in that part of the world are salmonids?
It's not quite that simple. I mean, that is a fact. You know, Maine is more of a salmonid state than a non-salmonid state. But we are native fish, and we are as likely to take a position on a non-salmonid as we are a salmonid, and in fact, a non-game fish as we are a game fish. So in theory, we're a native fish group. In practice, we've become a bit of a native salmonid group. The reason is that, unfortunately, salmonids are typically the native fish that's in trouble. you know, we don't have a lot of problems with bass and pike and these other species. Conversely, if sulmonids aren't in trouble, most other species in that, you know, given water aren't in trouble. They've become the canary in the coal mine. They're an indicator species. They're such a sensitive species. They're more sensitive to angler exploitation. No species is stocked at the rate that sulmonids are. And, you know, warming water is going to affect, you know, cold water fish much quicker and much more severely than it is warm water fish. It, you know, wasn't the intention. It's just been, you know, where the fires are. And there are some, you know, and this is kind of a little confusing. I mean, as you know, lake whitefish are a sulmonid. The average person would never associate whitefish with trout, but they're in trouble in Maine. Big trouble. We've lost 50 populations. We've got some historic alewife waters where you know, we're trying to bring back the alewives, and we've got people railing against them because of this perceived impact they're going to have on non-natives established smallmouth bass populations. We would never take a position in favor of this wild smallmouth because it's a non-native species. I was disappointed, and still am, when the brown trout found their way up in a Lee's Ferry, the Colorado River in Arizona, and the feds did what they're supposed to do under the Endangered Species Act. They went in and started removing these brown trout in order to protect endangered humpback chub. Amazingly, some of the groups that should have supported the feds didn't. They went quiet. And that was disappointing because we shouldn't take a position that favors an introduced game fish at the expense of a native non-game fish. And that's exactly what happened. It's happening right now. You know, there's petitions out there to stop the feds from eradicating or controlling these brown trout. And there are people claiming, you know, it's going to negatively impact their livelihoods, and that's nonsense. Lee's Ferry has been a rainbow, non-native rainbow fishery for decades. Nobody goes there for brown trout. The brown trout weren't there. They're a newcomer, and therefore their, you know, removal or control has no negative economic impact on anyone. But the bigger problem is these fish came from way downriver. I mean, tens of miles, 40, 50 miles. So the question it raises is, why did these fish, they've been decades, 40 miles downriver. Why are they moving upstream all of a sudden? Is there a bigger problem? Is something happening that's driving, you know, these browns up into the Lee's Ferry tailwater? There's a lot of questions to be answered. You know, the other thing is people don't understand why they're a problem. They're a problem because they're much more piscivorous than rainbows. Rainbows in Lee's Ferry, they eat, you know, I don't know, last I read there were 34 species of midges, and they're eating aquatic worms. But, you know, brown trout are going to come up there and chow on, you know, endangered humpback chubs. And that's why the feds are doing what they're doing. But, you know, I was shocked at how silent the conservation community was on this and how few came to the defense of the feds for doing what the feds are paid to do.
You mentioned earlier that up in Maine, you guys have a few special populations, the Arctic char and the Atlantic salmon. And you said you've recently lost 3 of 11 populations of the Arctic char, and the Atlantic salmon are endangered species, correct?
Yes, federally endangered.
So what is going on with these populations? Are they starting to improve, or the Arctic char, you said you've recently lost some, are they still declining?
Yeah, we'll start with salmon. Atlantic salmon are, I don't know, 20, 25 years listed now. What a lot of people don't know is the federal restoration efforts have been suspended on the Connecticut River, the largest run in the East. That, by default, takes out Connecticut, Mass, and Vermont. So they've suspended the restoration effort, which is, it was millions, hundreds of millions, who knows, into, you know, recurring stocking, raising that river-specific strain and stocking them, and it just wasn't working. Returns were horribly low, and there was a lot of people gave up on it and said it wasn't worth the investment. And so the feds pulled the plug. They maintain the strain in a hatchery, so that if something changes or money comes or whatever, they can try again. But for now, it's suspended, and any chance of these coming back on their own is, you know, non-existent. So we have the Merrimack was next, working your way north. And the Merrimack River is likewise terminated. So that takes out eastern New Hampshire, leaving only Maine. The southern rivers in Maine, the Saco River, there's some efforts going on, but the likelihood of success on the Saco is pretty low. There's restoration efforts on the Kennebec, and they're 100% propped up by stocking and all kinds of husbandry, moving adult fish over dams, seeding eggs in incubators in the rivers, and likelihood of returning Kennebec Atlantic salmon, which were one of the first populations lost, is slim. Moving us to the Penobscot. Penobscot River is ground zero. If it doesn't happen there, it happens nowhere. It was interesting. I had a discussion when we first formed with an executive director out of Native Fish Society. You know, he talked about the declining runs of steelhead and et cetera in the Pacific Northwest. And folks out there get nervous when a run drops in, you know, hundreds or thousands of fish. Atlantic salmon runs are down at tens of fish. And they are exclusively maintained by stocking right now. The seven down east salmon rivers, they've all got independent strains. There's several hatcheries that are actually in the area now trying to prop them up. But, you know, the Denny's River, you know, it sees, you know, a handful of fish. The East Machias, it's a handful of adult fish returning. So if you terminated the federally sponsored stocking program, Atlantic salmon in the United States would blink out within 2 to 3 years, in my opinion, everywhere other than the Penobscot. And the Penobscot would probably, you know, go away in 10 years. It's that critical right now. You know, this is an iconic species that fed indigenous people. And you know, the first one caught in Maine every year was iced and sent to the White House. And, you know, celebrities like the ball player Ted Williams that came to Maine to fish, you know, the so-called king of fish. And so-called king of fish is in huge trouble. You know, these fish have a lot of problems, you know, warming oceans, commercial fishing, exploitation of their food source. Even up here in Maine on some of the restoration projects, you know, we're still pounding sea run smelts and alewives and out of the salmon rivers commercially, recreationally. And, you know, people don't seem to fully understand that, you know, these other species played a critical role. You know, the whole way the salmon thing worked was, you know, hundreds of thousands of smelt would drop back to the ocean with, you know, a handful of, you know, juvenile salmon mixed in. And, you know, the stripers or whoever would, you know, eat. And hopefully some of these salmon would get through and did get through. So it, you know, it's disappointing to see, you know, we're spending all this time and money and effort trying to bring back salmon, but we're still exploiting the so-called buffer species that were helping them get, you know, to the ocean so that they could come back.
Archar, formerly known as blueback trout, sunapee trout, these fish exist in their native waters in just 11 waters in the contiguous United States, all of which are in Maine. They're relatively common in parts of Canada, but we're down to 11. Of those, two have been reclaimed in the last less than a decade due to invasive smelt introductions, and neither can be said to be successful yet, regardless of what some want to believe. We've got another one that's not only infected with non-native smelt, but we just learned that there's lake trout in there, non-native lake trout as well. That wasn't made public. People were running around under the assumption that we had a smelt problem for a couple of years before, you know, kind of accidentally leaked out that we also have a lake trout problem. And it is believed that in the case of the sunapee fish, that it wasn't landlocked salmon or smelt, competition, food and space, predation. It was hybridization with lake trout. So we've now got a pond that's, you know, this population's being hit from two sides. The smelt are competing with them for food and space. They're preying on the juveniles. And now we've got the potential of hybridization occurring on top of that mess. The waters that were restored were 90 acres. This is 1,150 acres. Quick estimate,
It's a $1.5 million reclamation. That we don't have that money. That money's not there. And that's a high-risk restoration project. So I think it's fair to assume that this population's actually lost. We're looking at the first truly lost population in Maine since Rangeley in the mid-1800s. These others are, yet to be determined as to their status. So, that's pretty significant. And acreage-wise, it's X percent of the total number of ponds, but its acreage is double what the percentage of ponds. I think it's 20-something percent of the remaining acreage goes down the toilet with this one loss. And, of course, one out of 11 ponds is a pretty hard hit as well. So, that's what we're up against. And, it's reasonable to assume that there's more coming. We've built some ill-advised roads and boat launches into a couple of these waters, three waters that are interconnected in what they call the Dabuli region. There's now, public reserve land, state-owned land with shoreside campsites, boat launches, etc. I hate to say it, jinx us, whatever, but it's just a matter of time before somebody, brings smelt or something else in there. And when they do, we're probably, we'll definitely take out two waters because two of them are connected by a 100-foot long throughfare with a less than a foot elevation change. And the other ones, a couple hundred yards away, but again, navigable streams. So we could lose three out of the remaining. You could say right now we have 11, but we could have eight if these two reclamations and this recent disaster, prove to be too much. And, we could lose another three if something stupid happens up on Dabuli. And, it's amazing that you could have this fish and not do, a little bit more to guarantee its safe passage over the next decades or however long this can hang on.
Maine has a few waters with these fish in them that have never been stocked, and they are listed as a state heritage water. Can you talk a little bit more about how special those waters are?
In 2001, Ted Williams wrote an article in Trout Magazine called Twilight of the Yankee Trout. Now, using numbers obtained from Fish and Game, they had roughly 500 never stocked waters remaining out of what was probably 1,500 or maybe more. All the others had been stocked at least once in their life. And it was a call to arms. It was ignored, as I had expected, because Maine was in denial at the time. We're a consumptive state. This is a state that's, right up till current, has been extremely reliant on resource extraction. And those are some of the hardest states to sell conservation in when they make their living cutting trees and commercial fishing and blueberries and on and on. So a decade later, some groups had been working, Sportsman's Alliance of Maine primarily, which is a hook and bullet. But to their credit, they were working to kind of via policy stop the stocking of never stocked waters. And this went on and on, and it just wasn't happening. And I actually joined their fishing initiative committee. At one point, people decided that this is just not going to happen voluntarily. And either, you fold up and walk away defeated, or you take, your game to the next level. And what that meant was take it to the legislature. So a group that I helped found called Dud Dean Angling Society, we got on with Sam and helped mostly accumulate data, create presentations, speak at hearings to drive this one home. It was pretty darn clear. From the time Ted had reported 497, the current number being debated was we were, per IFNW Fish and Game's own numbers, we were down at 276. So to lose over 200 waters to first time stockings in a decade, it was like where were we going to be a decade from now if we don't do something? So long story short, you know, this was taken to the legislature. To everybody's credit, they built one hell of a case. The story was compelling. The questions were tough. The answers to the questions were worse. They've got policies that say in the face of a declining fishery, you address tackle, bag limit, you know, length limit, seasons, and then closures, and then all else fails, you stop. Well, I did an analysis of the last 30 waters that I could find that were stocked for their first time. Every single one went from general law management to stocking with no interim action to try to mitigate the problem, which was, you know, somebody calling up saying the fishing's terrible. So, you know, that was the kind of things we brought to the legislature. I said, well, they have a policy that says, you know, stocking is a last resort. I said, here's the last 30 I could find. We're all from general law, which is unrestricted bait, 5 fish, 6 inches to stock. And that was a hard hitting data. We had maps. We showed where they're not. We talked to people in the legislative panel. One of the supporting legislators, I asked, how many do you think are left in your county? And he said, you know, dozen, Bob. And I said, zero, none. We stocked them all. And so, you know, this thing actually passed. It's a law. And even though Fish and Game opposed it, Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, Dundee Angling Society, TU at the local level, you know, enough people spoke, got behind it, and they made it happen. So while the department doesn't like it and certainly hasn't been fully in support of it, I mean, that would be more than fair to say because it's been an ongoing battle to get new waters added. But what we got was they can't stock without, you know, a lot of, I mean, unfortunately, it was originally legislative approval. Some people took their eyes off the prize, including myself, and some people made a stupid compromise that, you know, made it a little easier to do. I mean, there's a lot of public disclosure. There's an opportunity to oppose. We just opposed a couple and won, thankfully. Three waters were opposed, and we were able to turn back two of them. So it's a law, you know, and they can't stock, and they can't allow live fish as bait. So all of these waters that had unrestricted bait were flipped to no live fishes bait. While we went after never stock waters, unanticipated change was that the legislators started acting, the panel started asking about, you know, their favorite water. Would it be protected? And I said, nope, it's been stocked 40 years ago, you know, 30 years ago, whatever. And, you know, this was kind of the who's who of Maine brook trout waters. So amazingly, they started looking at each other saying, okay, so what are we going to do to protect these waters? These are ultra important. They're not stocked now. What do we do? They kind of threw out some numbers, not necessarily scientific, but, you know, we got out of there with a request to Fish and Game to come back with a list of waters that should get the same protections, previously stocked but not stocked now. And they drew some arbitrary line in the sand and said if they haven't been stocked in 25 years. Well, that doubled the number of waters. We were going after 276. We ended up with, you know, 578. So as it stands, Maine has 578 self-sustaining brook trout lakes and ponds, of which half of them or more have never been stocked. The others haven't been stocked in 25 years or more. Many had a single event. So, you know, these are important waters, and, you know, it's not easy for the department to go in and stock them. There's a big public notification process, hearings, etc., and they cannot allow live bait on them. And live bait is a gigantic problem in the state of Maine. You know, I tell people all the time, this isn't just a program. It's not just a policy. This is a law. And when in doubt, take the gloves off. If you can't get rational concessions from Fish and Game, protect, you know, wild native fish, then go the next route. Take it to legislation. You know, it's not the, you know, shouldn't be your first line of defense, but you certainly, you know, you can't blame people for, you know, taking it that far when the powers that be who have the authority to act refuse to act. So it's a unique program.
So you mentioned the work that's been going on in Maine mostly, but you've also mentioned New Hampshire and Vermont, and those states also have state chapters of your Native Fish Coalition. How active are each of these chapters in promoting and restoring native fish populations in each of their respective states?
We've had nowhere near the successes in New Hampshire and Vermont that we've had in Maine. And part of it is, you know, they have less to work with and there's more resistance to change, or there's less support for wild native fish in Vermont and New Hampshire than there is in Maine. One of the things I've kind of tongue-in-cheek said to people is that while a lot of Mainers would disagree as to how to get there, one thing is they love their brook trout. They don't care about browns and rainbows. So the mere fact that we're all on the same page as to what we want, that's a huge plus. Because now we just all got to figure out how to get there, how to save these fisheries. You know, segue into New Hampshire, they love their rainbows. Vermont loves their browns. New Hampshire is so damn dependent on stocking that, you know, when you start talking to people about trying to, you know, develop more wild fisheries, they spook. They're thinking, you know, wow, you know, we mess with this stocking, we might not have any fishing. When we started working with some of the trout conservation groups in New Hampshire and Vermont, I mean, I was stunned at how often the conversation would go, okay, well, we've got some concerns with your positions on stocking. And I would be like, you should have these same concerns. You're a trout conservation group. We got, you know, trout conservation group chapters paying to stock fish in those states, running, you know, stockfish tournaments. So, you know, we've got our hands full in New Hampshire and Vermont. As I said, Vermont has 12, you know, fish daily limit on brook trout and rivers and streams. We couldn't even get Trout Unlimited to support us on that. We worked and worked with these chapters up there, and they, one after another, refused to have any part of this attempt to get that reduced. And they had tried 5 years ago to make it happen and failed. You know, there's a lot of hearsay, you know, who did what, who showed up. But, you know, our proposal was different. They have a 12 fish daily trout aggregate limit, of which no more than six can be browns or rainbows. What we were saying, unlike what Vermont TU tried to do, which was reduce the 12 fish aggregate limit, we just wanted to bring brook trout down with browns and rainbows, to say, keep your 12 fish limit, but no more than six can be any species. I could care less what happens to rainbows and browns in Vermont. You know, it was a better plan. You know, we could have, you know, we would have had a much better shot if we had had a, you know, solid backing from some of the other groups. I'm hoping we can revisit it, but, you know, they are dug in beyond belief and defensive as heck. Segue into New Hampshire, who's, you know, virtually every river or stream in the White Mountains that's reachable by road is stocked. They're stocking over wild fish in New Hampshire by rule, not exception. Most of the wild native brook trout you find in New Hampshire are headwater streams now. You know, they have one marquee river called the Dead Diamond, and, you know, we're struggling to keep that thing from being, you know, rolled back. They have a formal program called Wild Trout Management, and it's a wonderful program. It has science-based inclusion criteria. It's pounds per acre, regardless of whether there are stockfish present or not. If the wild trout biomass exceeds this metric, then it's, you know, it is worthy of inclusion. And the prohibited acts, once so designated, are way better than Maine's state heritage fish law. These are barbless hooks, catch and release, short season, artificial lures only. Problem? It's got 16 waters statewide. I mean, that's laughable. New Hampshire has 16 wild trout waters? Of course not. It has maybe 100. I don't know. But it certainly has more than 16. Three are ponds and 13 are streams. All of these were being stocked prior to their inclusion. And all of them are still trout fisheries today. So right there tells you that these were unnecessary stocking programs. If you suspended them and you still have trout, then you didn't need to stock. How many other places are being stocked that under the same rules could be wild fisheries? Interestingly, they haven't added a water in 12 years. They call the program ongoing. So when I've, you know, reached out to them, it's ongoing. I said, well, it's ongoing, but you haven't added anything in 12 years. That's not my definition of ongoing. But clearly the management has soured, and this is not unusual to find state fish and game biologists, managers, commissioners who see stocking as job one. They become very husbandry-centric. And I don't believe they fall out of school thinking that the answer are trout woes or hatcheries. I just think they get indoctrinated into this system that doesn't work, and off they go. But, you know, I've got one water in New Hampshire. She's been the local biologist. She's been looking at this, doing surveys for several years now. The wild trout biomass exceeds the inclusion criteria fourfold, and she still won't add it to the list. And she's agreed to reduce, to stop stocking, but not apply protective ricks. And I have to come back and say, well, how do you think these, why did you start stocking in the first place? You started stocking it because of a declining fishery. The fishery was declining because of angler exploitation. Now you're going to stop stocking, but not address, you know, angler exploitation. You know, will it work? Maybe, but it's as likely not to work. And, you know, the goal isn't to improve it. Her whole focus is on sustaining it to what it was is today. If it can be as good tomorrow as it was today without putting restrictive regs, success, we move on. And I'm saying, well, we don't know what it could be. How about we put on some restricted regs to see if we can increase size, quality, population densities, whatever. So we've set the bar so damn low that, you know, it's hard to get people heading in the right direction. So our New Hampshire and Vermont group have their work cut out for them, more so than us, less to work with, and a dangerous lack of appreciation for wild native fish and a dangerous lack of effective advocacy. But, you know, we'd like to get down into Massachusetts. We'd like to get down in Connecticut and Vermont and Rhode Island. Rhode Island's got a small group, Protect Rhode Island Brook Trout. Their focus is pretty much a single river, and it's been an ongoing battle. Mass has, you know, their primary focus on brook trout right now, it's Sea Run Brook Trout. Sea Run Brook Trout Coalition, one of the TU chapters down there, seems to be quite committed to sea runs as well. But there's a, you know, whole bunch of water, you know, outside the 495 belt that likewise should be managed better. I lived there for a long time, and I can tell you firsthand, as somebody who's not afraid to crawl around in the woods looking for trout, that many, many of these streams are, you know, devoid of brook trout at this point and probably could be restored. And others are being stocked that shouldn't be. So, you know, I'd like to see an expanded presence down there that got beyond, you know, the sea runs. You know, what they've done with Sea Run Brook Trout down on Red Brook is phenomenal. You know, to have a self-sustaining brook trout population on Cape Cod, you know, that's a wonderful thing. That wasn't there when I was young, and I commend the efforts of Sea Run Brook Trout Coalition, Mass Fishing Game, and TU for making that happen. But that's an old victory, and, you know, we need to get beyond Red Brook and replicate that success in five other Red Brooks. And, you know, what seems to be stalled out is, you know, Red Brook was, you know, it is to Mass Salters what the rapid is to Maine inland, you know, river brook trout. You know, it's the blueprint. It's the place we do everything right. And, you know, they're both the premier fishery of their type because we do everything right. And taking that blueprint and changing it because of social pressures or a lack of commitment from Fish and Game, whatever, and expecting to replicate the results is wrongheaded. And this is, you know, the problem we face everywhere is, you know, we've got blueprints that work, so let's use them. There's a reason, you know, Red Brook is the best salter fishery down there. It's catch and release. It's had habitat work. It's private land. You know, it's the blueprint. Do everything right and good things happen. Now let's take that blueprint and bring it over to the Quashnet and some of the others. And, you know, one thing people don't talk a lot about is, you know, while, you know, Red Brook ramped up, the Santawit blinked out, just gone. That brook trout fishery disappeared in last year, 2 years ago. Don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, but it happened. And, you know, so it's that kind of two steps forward, one step back thing.
So you mentioned a few potential states that might be interested in forming chapters in your coalition, but what about states with no native salmonids but still interested in promoting native fishes? Are you welcoming them into your coalition at the moment?
Yeah, we would turn away no one. You know, we're going to have way more trouble recruiting chapters than turning away chapters. you know, if we survive. I mean, we would like to grow in a contiguous fashion, push our way south. Now, would we leapfrog a couple of states? Absolutely. Do we have any desire to go into, you know, the Rocky Mountains, the Northwest? No. Yeah, we couldn't do it. Plus, there are groups that are doing it, Native Fish Society and others. So there's, you know, there's so much to be done in regard to native fish that the last thing we need to do is replicate other people's efforts. But if somebody came to us and they were a warm water state in an area that it didn't appear that anybody had a real focus on the natives, we would absolutely talk to them because, you know, as I said, it's, you know, it's called Native Fish Coalition for a reason, not Native Trout Coalition. You know, I tell people today's bass fisherman, he, in some ways, he's a better conservationist than today's trout fisherman. You know, these guys are practicing catch and release, artificial lures only. They don't want, you know, non-native pike in their native bass waters any more than I want bass in my native trout waters. You know, they're not reliant on hatcheries. You know, and I tell people all the time, how the heck did the bass fishermen get out ahead of us? You know, I don't see them clamoring for, you know, hatcheries. I do see some disturbing stuff with hybrids, you know, of swipers and this other stuff. You know, but beyond that, you know, the warm water guy is, he's a better conservationist than people think. He's also dealing with a fish that, you know, can take more. But, you know, there's some really cool, you know, paddlefish and things like that. That, you know, up here we have cusk. I don't think we know enough about cusk. It wouldn't surprise me for us to get in trouble with cusk. I would have told you when I was young, we could never have gotten in trouble with whitefish, but sure enough, we did. One of the things, a lot of it's introduction of non-native species, but you know, how much of it did we do with angling? I mean, we just don't know. You know, I saw some weird stuff recently, and I think they were paddlefish, but a bunch of, you know, local guys holding up these big prehistoric looking, you know, I think they're a lower Yellowstone River stuff, but you know, do we know enough about those fish? Can they take that, you know, kind of pressure, you know, sturgeon and stuff? I mean, you know, it's complicated stuff. I mean, you can't have your foot in every fire in the world. And as a result, you know, we often, you know, are asleep at the wheel and stuff catches us, you know, by surprise.
So if anyone is interested in forming a chapter, how would they go about doing that?
info@nativefishcoalition.org. You know, we would talk to anybody, you know, we can't guarantee anything, but, you know, we would talk, and if it made sense and it was the right people, critical mass, and they had a good focus, we've had several misfires and false starts where other people from some states were fishermen, they like brook trout, and, you know, deep into the conversation, they start talking about, well, you know, what about our, you know, self-sustaining brown trout? What's our position there? And I said, well, your position there is if they're on top of wild brook trout, they're a bad thing. If they're in a system that's beyond repair, I mean, nobody picks a fight you can't win. I said, we're not by any stretch running around saying, let's stop, you know, brown trout. Our focus is focus our energies on places we can fix, protect places that are okay now that might not be okay tomorrow, restore places that used to be okay and aren't, but can be restored. I can fix a 30-acre brook trout monoculture that's been infested with shiners. I can't fix, you know, the Rapid River smallmouth bass situation because I've got this giant lake at the bottom of it that's now, you know, infested with bass, and there's nothing that stops them from pounding their way up into the rapid. So that game's over. But when we talk to somebody in an area where you could make headway and they're more worried about, you know, their naturalized native rainbows and browns, we walk because, you know, that's not, you know, a position we can take. You can't make, you know, exceptions that shouldn't be made. You make exceptions where it's futile to try to address it. And it's not just ecologically futile. It's economically futile. It's socially futile, you know, futile. There's a lot of reasons why, you know, you wouldn't go after a certain body of water. You know, so that's the whole key is, you know, find people who have that absolute focus, who understand, you know, where that line is drawn.
All right, Bob. Well, the tough part of the interview is finally over, and we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions that I ask each of the experts that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Right now, brook trout. Used to be brown trout. From a pure angling standpoint, brown trout's the, you know, fights hard, eats big streamers, it's smart. But today, it's brook trout.
And what is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
Career or fishing?
Oh, well, you kind of made a career out of fishing, so what is your favorite memory?
I've got a bunch, but recent one that stands out is my first fly-caught Maine Arctic char up in the Dabuli region.
What is your dream job or dream location to live in?
Dream job would be absolute unemployment, full-time advocacy, paid advocacy so that I didn't have to have a job, or financial independence so I didn't need the money. As far as where, I had convinced myself that I belonged in the Rocky Mountains for years. I was a foot out the door for well over a decade, and I'm not sure anymore. You know, I love the big woods. I love the complement of predators and, you know, the rich prey populations and the lifestyle. But I'm starting to question whether, you know, the native fish mean enough to me that, you know, I'd probably follow the native fish. If I went west, you know, it wouldn't be Montana like it would have been a decade ago. It would be Wyoming. It would be somewhere with cutthroat and grizzly bears and wolves.
And this next question is usually kind of geared towards research or research projects. But if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Restoring native fish in general, where viable. If I had to be more specific, it would be Arctic char. It would be the other favorite species, you know, Gila trout and Apache trout. But it would be some native trout restoration. Because as an angler, I'm a trout guy. I'm not a warm water guy. I've never been really, you know, had a brief foray into bass fishing, and I liked it. But I'm a trout guy, so it would be something native and something in the restoration world.
And then finally, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everybody's head, what would it be?
Native first and no hatcheries. Wild native. That's, you know, that's what I'd try to drive home is, you know, this all worked quite well at one point. You know, why did we fix something that wasn't broke?
Short and simple. Native first. Well, Bob, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure learning about you and your organization. If people want to find out more information or to get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
info@nativefishcoalition.org. Those come to me. I'm very responsive. I clear my emails every night. We have a very good website. We are operating under absolute full disclosure. We post every document, every letter, every presentation we do. We have campaigns posted so you can see what we're working on. We have a fun photo gallery, all wild native fish. We're doing a huge project right now in Maine, volunteer effort, where we're putting signage on the state heritage fish waters. And there's ways to donate to help offset. We've got 578 waters, over 1,000 signs, probably 1,100 signs and hardware that are going up on where raising the money. We're putting the volunteers in the woods. We're putting up signs ourselves, and you know, we're going in with GPS where there are no trails. But you can look that up on our campaign page, and you can see pictures of folks from Maine from all walks of life. In the woods, smiling next to their state heritage fish water sign. And as I said, Mainers love their brook trout, and this project is proof. We're getting support from amazing number of people from all walks of life, from everything from the person who fishes because they like to eat brook trout to the person who wouldn't kill a brook trout if you put a gun to their head. And so you can look at those projects. You can look at some of our char work. You can see we've done informational signage for Atlantic salmon waters, for Arctic char waters. Our belief is you got to start there. Start with information and education. Make sure everybody knows, you know, what the concern is. Make sure people know what the laws are, and then go from there.
So we also have a very active Facebook page. Ted Williams, our national chair, he runs the Facebook page. Myself and a couple others contribute, but Ted blogs and posts links to related stories, and it's a good place to get your native fish fix.
And the store on your website has a wide variety of things to purchase, everything from a Making Native Fish Cool Again bumper sticker to hats and koozies, and the signs that you've mentioned are also available for purchase.
Yeah, that's a part of a branding effort. You know, it's getting that, not branding us, but branding the term native fish. And, you know, we're doing it with trucker hats, flat brims, decals, koozies, and that Making Native Fish Cool Again started as a joke, make native fish great again. And to remain, you know, nonpartisan, we backed off and said Making Native Fish Cool Again. And I've been bumping into those stickers in the woods, and that's great when people understand that message and share that message and support that message. And all that money goes to our initiatives. You know, all of our swag sales are profitable, and they all fund conservation initiatives.
And if you would just like to make a donation, the Native Fish Coalition is a 501c3 organization, so donations are tax deductible.
Yes, and you can donate through our homepage, and a lot of our campaign pages have links back to, you know, project-specific donations, and we have memberships. We have student, individual, lifetime, family, and they'll be getting a newsletter soon, and they get a decal, and they help. You know, as I said, we are getting money from nobody. We are raising it the hard way. We've had a couple of generous, you know, small grants, but we are not, you know, getting, you know, federal money. We're not getting state money. Nobody's making a nickel. We're barely covering our expenses, and so donations, memberships, swag sales, that's what makes this happen.
And the website again was nativefishcoalition.org. And if you would like to contact Bob, you could reach him at info@nativefishcoalition.org. And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you can shoot me an email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. I'm not entirely sure who will be on the next episode yet, so pay attention to Twitter or Facebook for an announcement regarding that. Regardless, download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it on Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. If you have any people, projects, or topics you'd like to hear about, reach out and let me know. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 8th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, native fish first.